Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live is a renowned poet, author, explainer, and interpreter of fairy tales and myths. He, as a young man, grew up in a farm in the Midwest. He would spend great times in the vast silences of his farm that would inspire his writing of poetry. And throughout his life, he has been an outspoken opponent to the Vietnam War and most recently the Iraq War. And he has a new collection of poetry out, which is called, it uses the same number that he uses in other books as well. It's called My Sentence Was a Thousand Years of Joy. And many of the poems appear addressed to himself because he addresses a certain Robert in each of the poems. Please welcome Robert Bly to West Coast Live. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
The poetry of the new book is about an approaching end of life, which I assume you're thinking about for yourself.
Well, are you thinking about it?
I think about it every day. Isn't that what Buddha said to do? Think about death once a day?
Yeah.
But in particular, I mean, rather than some of the poems about love, even though love is a subject in here, this is about the end of the day.
Well, maybe, but many of the poems, I mean, we're trying to really humiliate the Muslims. And this book tries to honor them by bringing over their major poetic form called the Ghazal, or the Ghazal.
G-A-H-A-R-Z-A-L in our language?
G-A-Z-A-L, Ghazal, yeah. And they do a lot of talking about the end of life. So I like that very much. And it has several characteristics, one of which is that you have only 36 syllables to say what you want to say. Then you have to change the subject.
And so that is good for making leaps of one kind.
Exactly. It sets up leaps already. Yeah. And another characteristic is that they don't rhyme, but they end every stanza with the same word.
Which in one of those words, one of those poems, the word is non-existence.
Yeah, and that's right. I don't know any other American poem that's ever used the word non-existence, even though we are kind of non-existent, you know.
As a young man, becoming a poet in the world, you lived a lot on your own, and you made a comment, I think, in a Paris Review interview that you had found that you lost touch with a common language because of your isolation, and that it was important as a poet to have a common language.
I don't remember saying that, but I said a lot of things I don't remember. But I think it's I think poetry is connected with solitude, and I think it's the worst thing about modern life is that we aren't alone enough, and so I spent a long time was alone for 2 years in New York in my early 20s, hardly saw anyone. I was almost like a street person, and then I lived alone on the farm a while, and eventually I had kids, and that's the end of being alone. But it was all a blessing.
But then the kids grow up and go away after a couple of decades.
That's right, but others come and, you know, your friends come.
Your friends.
And I live at your house. Yeah.
There's a network of friendship in the world of poetry that you grew up and maintained. You'd make use of the U.S. mail. Letters would be sent back and forth. A colleague of yours and you agreed that you would have to write a poem to the other one every 48 hours. Within 48 hours.
Yeah, we did that sort of thing. Don Hall and Galway Canal and I wrote each other an awful lot of letters. And it was a great joy. And I happened to be in New York for Galway's 70th birthday. And I said, you know, remember when we send these endless letters? Include poems and talk, and they were 3, 4, 5 pages long. Do you think the younger poets do that sort of thing now? And one of them spoke up and said, well, if we did, we'd delete it.
That's sad.
It is sad. But Don Hall and I have written, I think, something like 15,000 letters to each other. And he won't print them. And he says, why? He said, because they're on rewritten prose. And I said, well, you idiot, that's what a letter is.
Unrewritten prose.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's something about the way that we can write letters now with word process, I suppose, where we want to make it rewritten. It's easy to rewrite it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
When you've written these poems in your most recent collection, the guards all. Well, did it take a lot of rewriting, or do the stanzas come quickly?
I did one book called The Night Abraham Called to the Stars 4 years ago, and there was 48 of them in there. And then I decided to do another book, and it took 4 years for 48 poems, roughly one poem a month. Because it's a very difficult thing. Don't you want to hear one?
Yes, I do. I do.
So I also putting out a book called The Winged Energy of Delight, which is my selected translations, and I'll read you a beginning here with a little poem by the Swede Thomas Tranströmer. We got ready and showed our home. The visitor said, "You live well. The slum must be inside you." And I happen to be down at Granada Hills in L.A., and it's very like that down there. We got ready and showed our home. The visitor said, "You live well. The slum must be inside you." Well, that's a little punch in the mouth, isn't it?
It is. It is. Is that's not a line that a real estate agent would necessarily.
No. But I love that whole issue. When the slums go way outside, does that mean we're going to have more slums inside? Probably. Anyway, you want to hear a poem, do you?
Well, that was a bit of a poem, and a bit on your am I right in remembering that you're the first poet to have translated Neruda into English?
Well, I did some early Neruda, yeah, and he was great, you know. One of his poems began, "It so happens I'm sick of being a man. So happens I'm sick of my fingernails and my toenails and my shadow. And happens I'm sick of being a man." I love that.
And
he said, "It'd be great." No, he says it. "The smell of barbershops makes me want to break into horse sobs. The only thing I want is to lie still like stones or wool. The only thing I want is to see no more stores, no gardens, no more goods, no spectacles, and no elevators. So happens I'm sick of my feet and my toenails and my hair and my shadow. I'm sick of being a man. Nevertheless, it'd be marvelous to terrify a law clerk with a cut lily. It'd be tremendous to kill a nun with a blow in the ear." I mean, he's chilly, and he can say that if he wants to. "It'd be great to go through the streets with a green knife letting out yells until I die to the frost." I mean, that poetry is so great. It's so tremendous.
And how much of that then becomes your voice as well? I mean, you must laugh in the translation process, and as you try to fit an English word and an English verb to a Spanish verb.
Well, yeah, you do. And then you say, "Listen, you know, I never heard this in a sonnet. You know, I'm sick of being a human being." So the more you translate, I've translated 19 or 20 poems, and the more you translate, the more you realize you're not expressing who you are. There's other people inside there who haven't had a chance to talk yet. So I'm 78 or something. This is the best book I've ever done. So, you know, you learn eventually.
Yeah. Well, and you're working on other poems every day. You do morning poems.
Yeah, I get up in the morning, and I got that, as you mentioned, from Bill Stafford. I lay in bed. I just lie in bed for 3-4 hours and see what happens.
Yeah. And that is akin to sort of sitting in a field to see what would happen.
Yes, that's what I used to do, but now I stay in bed. It's I like it better, yeah.
That poem about... I am tired of being a man. Is that a poem that is part of your various workshops on men and with men? And
well, maybe I read anything to men, but most of them are not sick of being a man. They wonder what it does mean to be a man. You know what I'm saying? There's so much uncertainty, and the women seem to know what they're doing, and they seem to know what they're talking about, and the men wake up and they say, "What? What is going on? What kind of world is this? I mean, what is it to be a man?" So it's touching to talk to the younger men about that, especially. And I just say to them, you know, if you want to do something in the world, you know, get a hold of your father and start to talk to him. If your father, get a hold of your son. Take him out to a vacation somewhere in Colorado where there are no books or no movies and sit on the side of a hill for 3 hours or 3 days. That's my advice. I'm a tourist.
How do you explain in that sort of context what it is the men and I suppose now women of our country are doing when we have attacked Iraq in the way that we have?
Well, I think it's a disgrace, absolute and total disgrace. And I have a book here which is called The Insanity of Empire, and I was going to call it The Insanity of American Empire. And I said, no, it's just... I mean, we got a guy with a C, C average, and we asked him to run an empire. I mean, police. Police. So... One of the guzzles I wrote is called Call and Answer, and it was probably the first poem written against the Iraq War. Shall I read it? Mm-hmm. Tell me, and I was very upset because we'd had a lot of stuff during the Vietnam War, people protesting all the time. It's too much silence. Tell me why it is we don't lift our voices these days and cry over what is happening Have you noticed the plans are made for Iraq and the ice cap is melting? I say to myself, go on, cry. What's the sense of being an adult and having no voice? Cry out. See who will answer. This is call and answer. We'll have to call especially loud to reach our angels who are hard of hearing. I mean, they are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Remember me, Reagan even invaded Grenada. Nobody said anything. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Have we agreed to so many wars that we can't escape from silence? If we don't lift our voices, we allow others who are ourselves to rob the house. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Anikmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're silent as sparrows in the little bushes? It's a very bad pun, but I let it be. We are silent as sparrows in the little bushes. Last stanza. Some masters say our life only lasts 7 days. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry, cry now. Soon Sunday night will come. And it came when he bombed Iraq. So that's also in the guzzle form. And the guzzle form enables you to talk about things without droning on in the old way. You just jump from here to here and here, and if people don't get it, the hell with them.
You hope they catch up at some point. I'd like to hear a poem from the new book as well.
Do you want to hear a sweet poem or a hard poem? What do you want?
Sweet. Sweet.
I'll give you one hard and one sweet. We have time for that?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're the one who has to catch a plane.
It's all right if Suzanne goes on painting the same picture. I mean, I'm old enough to say now it's okay. I say, it's all right if Suzanne goes on painting the same picture. It's all right if juice tastes bitter in our mouths. It's all right if the old man drags one useless foot. The apple on the tree of paradise hangs there for months. We wait for years and years on the lip of the falls, and the blue-gray mountain keeps rising behind the black trees. It's all right if I feel the same pain until I die. That's what the comic was saying here, too. It's all right if I feel the same pain until I die. A pain that we have earned gives more nourishment than the joy we won at the lottery last night. It's all right if the partridge's nest fills with snow. Why should the hunter complain if his bag is empty at dusk? It only means the bird will live another night. It's all right if we turn in all our keys tonight. It's all right if we give up our longing for the spiral. It's all right if the boat I love never reaches shore. If we're already so close to death, why should we complain? Robert, you've climbed so many trees to reach the nests. It's all right if you grow your wings on the way down. So another quality of the guzzle is that you refer to yourself in the last stanza. And no one knows why that happened. Maybe in the 10th century, they were all sung in various cafes, and so you identified yourself. But it also means that you can turn to yourself and say something, like I said in one poem. You know, the images in this poem are not bad. They're not so bad, and probably as good as anyone can do who is still living in the old Inn of Desire. Robert, these poems are probably as good as anyone can do who is still living in the old Inn of Desire. Yeah, you know, you can tease yourself a little bit. Yeah.
You don't seem averse to that.
No, I like it. I mean, I know about more bad things about me than anyone else, so why should I hold back? You know what I mean? And I love that thing, to come in at the end, and instead of saying, I hope you read this poem, you just say, Robert, what the hell are you doing? Please. We got time for one more poem. This is a poem I titled the book from. It's called Stealing Sugar from the Castle. And one form of stealing sugar, if you write poetry, is to translate. And this is all stealing sugar stuff from Juan Ramon Jimenez, the Spanish, and all that. So you're looking at a person who's been stealing sugar.
And this is the sugar bowl you're referring to here is the winged energy of delight.
There's a lot of poets in there. Are you ready? Stealing sugar from the castle. So I said the characteristic of the guzzle is that you don't rhyme, but you repeat the same word at the end of each stanza. So the word here, well, I'm saying, we are poor students who stay after school to study joy. We are like those birds in the Indian mountains. I'm a widow whose child is her only joy. So I identify joy as the one that'll be repeated. The only thing I hold in my ant-like head is the builder's plan of the castle of sugar. just to steal one grain of sugar is a joy. Like a bird, this is from Beowulf, human life is like a bird flying into one of those halls where everybody's singing, and then it flies out the other side into the snowstorm. That's what a human life is like. It's very short. Like a bird, we fly out of darkness into the hall, which is lit with singing, and then fly out again. Being shut out of the warm hall is also a joy. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. But I love to read about those who caught one glimpse of the face and died 20 years later in joy. You know, I'm thinking about the great old love poets. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and a friend said, well, you know, you're not a loafer, Robert, but the other two are true. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. But I love to read about those who caught one glimpse of the face and died 20 years later in joy. I don't mind you saying I will die soon. I mean, I don't mind you too much, you saying I will die soon. See, he's saying it, you know. I don't mind you saying I will die soon. Even in the sound of the word soon, I hear the word you, which begins every sentence of joy. I don't mind you saying I will die soon. Even in the sound of the word soon, I hear the word you, which begins every sentence of joy. The last stanza. You're a thief, the judge said. Let's see your hands. I showed my calloused hands in court. My sentence was 1,000 years of joy. So that's how I got to the last line.
Robert Bly, his new collection called My Sentence Was 1,000 Years of Joy. It's an anthology called The Wing and Energy of Delight and poems about Iraq, The Insanity of Empire, a book of poems against the Iraq War, but applicable to almost any empire.
Yes, I think so. We're kind of come lately. You know, the English had an empire. They made a big mess of it, and the Indians threw their ass out. And they'll do that in Iraq to us. They'll throw our ass out. After we aren't getting any pensions anymore, you know why? Because that goddamn Bush spent $80 million or something on the Iraq War. That could have been pensions for human beings.
Waste.
I'm pissed off.
And don't mind telling us. Robert Bly here on West Coast Live. There was a story in the paper that scientists have noticed that if you gesticulate a lot, it helps with your memory of and use of words. And I notice the way you use gesture when you write.
Books in my hands, I gesture even more, you know. I'd love that. I'd love to feel something that you're saying inside goes out through your fingers and ends up over there somewhere. Yeah.
And we catch it in our ears, in our skin, in our eyes.
Yeah.
So the next volume, you'll be writing more.
Yeah, I don't know what, but my wife and I are doing a book together. We're taking two fairy stories and discussing them and so on. Anyway, it's sweet of you to invite me to come here.
It's sweet of you to make the trip. I know it was a journey, and I thank you very much.
I have a daughter who's graduating from nursing school at 4:30 this afternoon in L.A., and I forgot to get it right, so I got to fly back there right now.
All right, well, thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.